chest. He was careful to handle everything as little as possible. He memorized the locations of every item before moving something, then putting it back exactly as it was found. The goal was to be as thorough as possible without letting Fogula know that he'd been here at all. The search took him less than half an hour, and it revealed almost nothing useful. Though he did learn a great deal about Fogula. Letters from her father and little sister had come with her from Dionysus, as well as tokens of affection and a stack of unsigned love notes that looked to be a few years old. Mikel always struggled with this part of his job. Looking through the private parts of a person's life often revealed a more human side that he had to coldly ignore. Only one item caught Mikel's interest. It was a list of addresses filed away with a bundle of other papers in a hidden compartment of Fogula's sea chest. The addresses were most definitely in landfall, and the paper looked fairly new. A brief check against the addresses in her booklet told him that this was not her standard list of contacts. Mikel returned the bundle of papers to the sea chest, sans the list of addresses, and made sure everything was in its proper place. One more quick search of the house, and he locked the back doors and slipped out through a window, closing it carefully behind him. He couldn't help but be mildly disappointed as he left the industrial quarter on foot and climbed up the switchbacks to head back to the Merryweather Hotel. The list of addresses in his pocket might turn up something interesting, but it seemed that there would be no easy answers for Fogula's meetings with Mahouche. He couldn't help but decide that she was attempting to turn him, perhaps to get her own pet Black Hat and curry favour with her master, Sedil. If there was nothing sinister going on, he'd angered Fogula for very little reason. He was getting near the Hadshaw Gorge when he got the sense that he was being followed. Mikel switched directions, heading down a couple of side streets before reaching the main avenue that ran alongside the gorge. He was careful not to look directly behind him, only stopping from time to time to check his pocket watch or look in a store window, trying to get some kind of look at whoever might be on his tail. If anyone was there, they managed to elude him. His mood went from curious to uneasy, and he wondered if perhaps one of the Sedil household, or even Fogula herself, had spotted him leaving Fogula's house. He'd wanted to spend the afternoon catching up with a few old contacts, the type of people Tenik would disapprove of him meeting, but he couldn't risk leading any Dionysus to anyone who would raise suspicions. Perhaps he should head straight back to the hotel. If Fogula had spotted him, though, Mikel couldn't hole himself up with other Dionysus. He took a sudden turn into an alley off the busy street and stepped up against the wall, waiting for anyone he recognized to pass him by. He slipped both hands into his pockets and fingers into his knuckle dusters. He waited for 5 minutes, then 10. He was just beginning to think his paranoia had gotten the best of him when he heard the sound of a pistol cocking behind him. Slowly, Mikel turned to look back into the alley. Hendriz stood about 15 feet away, pistol raised, her face expressionless. How she had managed to sneak up on him, he had no idea. But he tried to put together a quick explanation for his actions, anything that might let him talk himself out of this. "Andres," he said. "Mikel." She breathed his name like a swear word. "You don't want to fire that here," Mikel said quietly. "You'll have soldiers down on top of you in a moment. Lower the pistol and we can talk. I'm not what you think I am." Slowly, so as not to risk a rash action on her part, he slipped his fingers out of his knuckle dusters and raised his hands. "We should talk." "No," Hendriz said. "We shouldn't." Mikkel saw the gun jump, only a split second before something slammed into his chest. He jerked backward and slumped against the alley wall, where he stayed for a few seconds while Hendriz watched him through the powder smoke. She turned and ran. Mikkel frowned at the lack of pain. Had she missed? Had a misfire caused the bullet to bounce off him? He touched a hand to his chest, a few inches below his heart. His fingers came back crimson. There was a burning sensation, like having a hot coal against his skin, and it took Mikkel's suddenly foggy mind several moments to come to terms with the fact that he'd been shot, and that he would probably be dead within a few moments. He stumbled to the next street, walking along with a wall on his right, his fingers leaving crimson prints against the plaster as he tried to propel himself on. Each step felt like a thousand miles, but he barely managed to go two blocks before he fell into the rubbish beside a doorway, his eyesight cloudy and his mind confused. He thought he heard a voice somewhere behind him, and wondered if Hendriz had returned to finish the job. Everything went black. Chapter 32. Before heading down the main avenue of Belport, Stike approached Carpole and let a horse nuzzle his hand.
"Why are you following me?" he asked. "Don't you have sorcery to do somewhere?"
She rolled her eyes and went through a series of hand motions. "She says that she's following you because you're her protector," Celine said, joining them with Amrek in tow. Stike eyed Celine.
"You picked that shit right up, didn't you?"
"She learns very quickly," Celine translated for Carpole.
"What do you mean I'm your protector? The whole of the Mad Lancers is your bodyguard. You're safer out there."
Carpole pursed her lips and signed. It took several repetitions before Celine was able to translate a coherent sentence.
"A Bonai needs a protector. I'm not incapable of defending myself, but I'm far more dangerous if I don't have to worry about physical danger."
"So go back with the Lancers," Stike said, getting frustrated.
"I haven't anointed the Lancers. I have anointed you. Besides, Taniel has trusted you with me. Neither of us wants to betray that trust."
Stike noted the fond way she smiled when she signed Taniel's name. He spat in the dust.
"What a prick you mean by anointing? Have you done any of that blood magic shit on me?"
He thought of that moment in the town outside of Landfall just before the invasion. Carpole regarded him coolly, but did not answer. This was not, Stike decided, the place to press the point. He didn't want to take her to task in public, and he definitely didn't want his men to witness him being stonewalled by a 100-pound palo woman. Besides, if she had put some kind of magic on him, he would have smelled it. Wouldn't he have?
"We'll talk about this again. I've a man to kill. Are you two coming?"
He climbed into Amrek's saddle and lifted Celine up after him.
"Are you going to let me watch you kill him?" Celine asked as they began to ride.
Stike sucked on his teeth.
He shouldn't.
He should turn around and leave Celine with Ibarna. Better yet, he should hand her over to Carpole and tell them both to get lost. But he had the feeling that wouldn't actually work. Besides, he also had the feeling that he shouldn't tell a child about his plans to kill a man in the first place. But that ship had sailed.
"Just stay out of the way when the fighting starts."
Stike followed a stranger's directions across the city, eventually reaching a warehouse on the main thoroughfare just outside the old city walls on the north end of town. The warehouse's main door had been replaced by a colonnaded facade in imitation of the boxing arenas in Landfall. above which was an enormous banner bearing a likeness of Valjean's upper body, fists held forward for a fight. The building had not been damaged by the shelling. The streets outside crowded with wounded and displaced citizens. Stike left Celine with Amric and entered through the front door. He was surprised to find that it wasn't just the facade that had been remodeled. The entire inside of the building had been turned into a clean, well-lit arena, including boxes, bleachers, and snack stands. It could easily fit 5,000 people, and from the busts and posters around the building, Stike gathered that there were shows every night. Valjean himself, one of the posters proclaimed, was a feature every weekend. The arena wasn't empty. It had been converted into a hospital for the victims of the shelling. Quiet moans filled the hall, coming from the countless wounded laid out on every surface. Surgeons and nurses rushed around, and Stike even spotted a woman in privileged gloves attending to the worst of the battered, filling the room with a brimstone smell of her sorcery. He breathed it in, enjoying the biting scent. Stike almost backed out. He didn't need to fight in a hospital, but Valjean was here somewhere. Stike could feel his blood begin to rise in anticipation of violence, and he caught the arm of a passing nurse. "I'm looking for Valjean Soris," he said. The woman looked him up and down, her eyes widening at his size. "I don't know where he is," she said, "but I'm in a hurry. I last saw him a few hours ago." She rushed off before he could question her further, leaving him empty-handed. He plucked at his big lancer's ring, running his thumb over the skull relief and looking around the hall. Maybe, he thought, it would be best to come kill Valjean on his way back through Belport.
"Stike?"
Stike turned around to find Valjean standing in the doorway, a load of fresh linen in his arms and a surprised look on his face. The surprise disappeared quickly, leaving behind something akin to resignation.
"Soris," Stike said, nodding slowly.
He examined Valjean in a heartbeat, taking in all the changes. Valjean wasn't a tall man, easily a foot and a half shorter than Stike, but he'd always been well-muscled. In the last 10 years, he'd grown positively enormous, with arms bigger around than Stike's, and a chest that looked like it could catch a cannonball without splitting. He had a square jaw and short jet-black hair, and he wore a businessman's suit and trousers.
"This is your place?" Stike asked, gesturing behind him. "It is."
Valjean passed by Stike warily, handing the linens off to a nurse. He looked Stike up and down, like a butcher prepping a piece of meat, his eyes lingering on Stike's knife.
"Heard you were still alive. Heard you saved at landfall." "Something like that," Stike replied.
He began to move slowly, keeping Valjean in his field of vision, and they began to circle each other in the vestibule of the arena.
"I heard you did a favour for Fidelis Jess a decade ago to buy you this."
He gestured around the arena. Valjean took off his jacket and lay it on a nearby bench, never once taking his eyes off Stike.
"Me? I got paid, sure. But I built all this myself." "How much did he pay you?"
50,000.
Stike scoffed.
"Agerston got 2 million.
"I also asked for a favor from Fidelis Jess. I never cashed it in. Didn't see the need. I'm not the greedy shit Agerston is."
"Was,"
Stike corrected.
"Right. You do him with that big knife of yours?"
"I did."
Stike tapped the underside of his jaw.
"Put it through the soft spot, here."
"You came across Central Fatrasta. I imagine Tenny is dead too?"
Very, Skike lied. Valjean sighed. He didn't seem frightened or even all that put out, just tired.
Duvory? He's next. He's got a field army at his back, so best of luck with that.
Valjean's eyes fell to Skike's knife.
You gonna take it personally when I fight back?
Skike almost laughed. That indignant anger now churned in his belly, but more than that, he felt alive as when he unleashed Amrek to a full gallop toward an enemy flank.
Traitor or not, I wouldn't begrudge a man a good fight. You wait here while I go get myself a knife.
Skike snorted. Despite Valjean's resignation, there was a light in his eyes. He, too, was looking forward to this. Skike made two fists. He didn't want this to go down like it did with Agaston. He wanted this to last.
We'll do this your way. Suit yourself.
Valjean rolled up the sleeves of his white dress shirt and flexed his fingers. They continued to circle.
Always liked you, Valjean.
Yeah? Well, I always thought you were a wanker.
Valjean darted forward faster than Skike expected, his arms coming up in a boxer's stance and his right fist lashing out and connecting with Skike's chin in a powerful jab that snapped Skike's head back and brought tears to his eyes. Skike stumbled, raising his arms in defense, taking two more jabs to the ribs before he could fend off the attack. Valjean retreated, bouncing on the balls of his feet, fists held high. Skike copied the stance, remembering his days fighting in the barracks well before the Mad Lancers. He swung at Valjean's head, but the punch was too slow. Valjean ducked beneath it, hammering his left side with a flurry of blows, causing Skike to double over, only to take a knee to his forehead. Skike fell back against the wall. His eyes were blurry, blood leaking from his nose and mouth and streaming from Valjean's knuckles.
"What are you doing, Ben?"
Valjean asked, dancing in front of Skike, feinting left and right.
"Is this part of some path of vengeance? Is this some kind of redemption? Get out that big knife and end this thing. It'll go faster."
He darted back in, pounding on the arm Skike raised in defense and leaping back from Skike's counter-jab. He continued to talk.
Do you think you're some kind of hero? Rumor has it that you threaten to crucify any soldiers you find stealing from Fatrestans. Is that true?
It wasn't, but Skike didn't see the need to correct him. It sounded like something he'd do. When he didn't answer, Valjean barked a laugh.
Ha! That's some hypocritical shit there, Ben. We never stole from the people we protected, Skike snapped.
He pushed himself off the wall and brought his arms in. He closed the distance between them, attacking Valjean with short jabs that the boxer simply slapped aside. Only one managed to land, hitting Valjean in the cheek and sending him reeling. Valjean recovered and spat blood at Skike.
We stole from everyone, he growled. You've got rose-colored spectacles, you big dumb asshole. If we needed something, we just accuse someone of being a royalist and take it from them. Maybe there was a veneer of honor to it, but never more than skin-deep.
The whole hall had grown silent, and Skike could feel the eyes of the doctors and nurses and wounded upon them as they continued to circle. He thought about his vengeance, and realized that to all these people, he was just a big, dumb soldier attacking their benefactor. The vengeance was only in his head. But then again, that's all that ever mattered. Valjean came at him again, smashing fists against Skike's arms, jabbing his ribs. Skike swung hard and low, ignoring a blow to his face in order to land his own. He felt something crack beneath his knuckles, and Valjean suddenly retreated again, holding his side. Valiant grinned.
Pete, I forgot how strong you are.
He spat out more blood.
You know, Ben, it's been so long I forgot what it was that Fidelis just said that made me decide to betray you. He prodded at all of us, you know, for over a year. He even tried to get to Ibana. Didn't anyone warn you?
He shook his head.
No, of course not. You don't warn Ben Stike. That's like warning a hurricane. What good would it do?
Stike wished Valiant would shut up and focus on the fight. This wasn't how it was supposed to go. This wasn't meant to be fun. Not for him, and definitely not for Valiant. This was just a man taking care of business. He swung with his left fist, letting Valiant duck under it, following up with his right and grabbing Valiant by the neck, lifting him and slamming him against the wall. Stike felt a kick against his knee and suddenly lost his balance. He gasped in pain as he fell, then felt Valiant's fist slam into the side of his temple with the force of a warhorse kick. Stike staggered to the side, seeing double, and turned back toward Valiant.
Ha ha ha! I've killed people with that punch, Valiant stated with an almost maniacal laugh. I never liked you, Ben. But I damn well respect you. You're a bloody mule. I love that. I love that you never go down. You know what? I remember what Jess said now, why I agreed to help him. Because he told me what it would be like having a monster like you roaming the countryside after the end of the war.
That's it? Stike demanded, trying to blink his vision back to normal. That's all it took you to betray me? Some hypothetical image?
Hypothetical? Oh, Pete, Ben! What kind of shit did you smoke in the labor camps? I was there. I saw the terror that was the Mad Lancers. We were a goddamn force of nature. Cutting off the head was the only way to stop us.
Valiant shook his head.
I wish it didn't come to that. I wish they'd all just gone home. But instead we had to leave with the worst kind of scars.
He tapped the side of his head.
Agoston spent all his money to climb into the bottom of a bottle for the last decade. Tenny Wiles got himself a wife and buried his head between her legs. Worst of all, Devore got put in charge of a whole field army as his reward from Jess. Between you and me, he never did care. I may dislike you, but Devore, he hates you.
Stike's vision finally began to clear.
And you?
Me? It bothered me for a year or two. Then I forgot about it. Got a career, made money, started to help people in the community. I set my bloodlust in a ring, and I've only killed a few men doing it. Sometimes I go on a mala binge. Helps me forget about the things we did in the name of freedom.
Stike could see Valiant settle his weight on his back foot, coiling like a snake ready to spring. He fell back a half step, and when Valiant leapt forward, he was ready. He caught the wrist of Valiant's right arm and jerked him past, grabbing his neck and using Valiant's own momentum to lift him clear off the ground. He spun, flinging Valiant with all his strength through the arena doors. The doors burst open, one of them snapping off the hinges as Valiant stumbled through them and into the street, reeling until he finally collapsed in the mud. Stike followed him out, removing his knife from his belt. To his surprise, Valiant wasn't even unconscious. He lay in a puddle with about as much grace as a man could, looking back up at Stike through hazy eyes and laughing quietly to himself.
"What's so funny?" Stike asked.
"You," Valiane said. "I always told Devore that you would never die. He insisted you were already gone, that Jez had put you in front of a firing squad, and a doctor pronounced you dead."
"And that's funny."
"He's always funny when Devore's wrong."
Valiane coughed and, slipping and sliding in the mud, slowly regained his feet. He eyed Stike's knife.
"What's really funny is that you don't even know what you actually are. You always demand the closest loyalty from your own men, but you never give your own."
"I've always protected Fatrasta," Stike protested.
He wondered why he bothered. He needed to step over and finish this with a swing of his knife.
"Tcha!" Valiane spat. "The concept. You've never been loyal to a person. You've never listened to a set of orders without thinking about how you are going to disobey them. You've never been Commander Ben Stike, the officer that everyone else can depend on. You've just been that force of nature. They pointed you at the people they wanted dead and hoped you didn't come around and get them all killed."
Valiane looked at the knife in Ben's hand and raised his fists.
"Let's finish it, big man."
Stike stared at Valiane. He stared hard, letting the words rattle around inside his mind. He needed to kill Valiane, to finish this whole thing off. He stepped forward, setting his foot for good purchase in the mud, and took a swing. Even as he went through the motion, he knew it was half-hearted. Valiane knew it too. He stepped into the swing, catching Stike's weak wrist with a quick jab that made his hand go numb. His knife fell from his hands. Valiane's next punch came all the way across the boxer's body and slammed into Stike's chest with immense power. Stike stumbled back, slipping in the mud, and fell. He struggled to breathe, looking up at Valiane. Slowly, Valiane lowered his fists. He took one step to the side, picking Stike's knife out of the mud, then tossing it to him, hilt first.
"I never wanted you dead, Ben. I just wanted things to end. You think about that real hard. Go slaughter Dionysus until you swim in blood. If you still want more, you can come back here and gut me. I'll even open my shirt for you."
Valiane turned around and walked back into the arena. Stike struggled to his feet. He'd killed men before for walking away during a fight. He watched until Valiane had disappeared, then limped across the street to where Carpol and Celine waited with Amric. Passers-by stared. He ignored them. Celine had a strange look on her face, Carpol a scowl. Stike took the reins from Celine and realized that she'd probably never heard anyone talk like that to him, like an equal who was sick of his shit. She asked in a quiet voice,
"Why didn't you kill him?"
It was an echo of the question she'd asked when he failed to kill Tenny Wiles. Stike sighed, knowing he was never going to hear the end of this from Ibarna.
"Because he beat me fair and square,"
almost came to his lips, but instead he said,
"because he wasn't wrong,"
and limped down the street with Amric in tow. Everything hurt. He hadn't been beaten that hard since the labor camp, and it wasn't a good kind of memory. He felt around with his tongue, making sure he had all his teeth, and gingerly touched his face. Broken nose, split lips, maybe a cracked rib. He still had a hard time breathing. He'd need a big supply of horn gum before he left town. They'd gone a few blocks when Stike suddenly spotted something out of the corner of his eye. He handed the reins to Celine, who still sat alone on Amric's saddle, and limped down the street toward an old man he'd spotted leading a horse.
"You there,"
he said, tapping the man on the shoulder.
"Eh?"
The old man turned, looked up at Stike, and did a double take.
"What do you want?"
Stike did a quick circuit of the horse, looking at teeth, eyes, hooves, and legs, while the man looked on, bewildered.
"It looks like a midget Rosvelin draft horse," Stike said.
"Not bred that way. She's just a runt. Can I help you with something?"
"How does she do with noise?"
"What's this about?"
the man demanded.
"Noise," Stike said. "How does she do with it? Quick movements, large crowds, all that."
"She does great," the man retorted. "She's a damned miniature war horse. Just too small for a soldier. What the pit do you want?"
Stike ignored the man's frustration.
"Name me a price, and I'll buy her right now."
The man looked around suspiciously before eyeing Stike for a long moment.
"1,000 kroner.
It was 300 more than the horse was worth.
"Done," Stike replied. "You bring her, and any kit you have for her, out to the Mad Lancer camp by nightfall. Tell Ibana Jaflez that Ben Stike bought a horse for the girl, and she'll pay you."
Stike left the man standing there stuttering, and returned to Carpole and Celine. Carpole had a small smile on her face, and Stike avoided looking her in the eye. "Who is that?" Celine asked.
"Just some man," Stike replied.
"What did you want with him?"
Stike took Amrek's reins, patting Celine gently on the arm.
"I wanted to buy his horse. She's yours. She'll be there by the time we go to bed tonight."
The look of joy on Celine's face made him forget all about his broken nose, Valjane, and the entire damned war. Unable to stop grinning, Stike led them back to the Mad Lancer camp. Chapter 33. Laura caught sight of Prime Lecter again 3 days after speaking with Taniel in the Yellow Creek jail. Finding him was purely luck. Laura was returning from another fruitless morning of searching the nooks and crannies of the mountains surrounding Yellow Creek. The newsies on her normal route had sold out of their papers already, so she went out of her way to find a street corner where the boys still had some stock. She just found a paper and folded it over to read while she walked, when her gaze swept across the familiar profile. Prime sat outside a cafe in the one small area of town that could be considered posh, if one squinted a little. It was midday, and he was enjoying a coffee, biscuits, and a newspaper while he faced away from the sun. Flora forced herself to act casual, turning slowly to cut across traffic and heading around to a nearby storefront where she could get a good look at his face without crossing his line of sight. Once she could clearly see the ink-vine birthmark that cut across the left side of his face, she knew he was definitely Prime Lecter. Flora waffled. A part of her wanted to walk over, pull up a seat, and ask Prime straight out why he was here. It was a foolish thought, one that she had no problem talking herself out of, and instead she circled around behind him and took a seat on a nearby stoop where she could keep an eye on him over her newspaper. She only half-read the articles as she watched the back of Prime's head. The news was all 2 weeks old and was filled with rampant speculation regarding the war, Dainai's military might, rumours of Lindit's assassination, and more. Nothing looked reliable, and it frustrated her to no end. So she turned her attention purely on Prime. One of the odd quirks of sorcery was that a powder mage could sense a privileged, but a privileged could not sense a powder mage. Laura did not know if the same rule applied to the Predii, but considering that Prime didn't just turn around and incinerate her, she assumed that it did. The immediate problem was that, while she definitely recognized Prime Lecter, she could not sense his sorcerous presence. He was cloaking himself from any such scrying. It would make him difficult to follow or predict. She tried to think of any possible reason for his presence in Yellow Creek, aside from the Godstone. Nothing came to mind, and that left her with a number of pressing questions. What were his intentions regarding the stone? Had he already found it? Was he alert and ready in case he was found, or was he complacent in his power? There were no easy answers, which meant Vlora would have to find them the hard way, the dangerous way. It was about 30 minutes before Prime folded his paper, finished off his coffee, and stood up. He was dressed as a frontier gentleman, with a tan cotton suit and matching top hat, a cane, and a pair of spectacles perched on the front of his nose. He surreptitiously took a look around before tucking the paper under one arm and heading down the street. Vlora followed at a distance. She didn't have to go far. Prime took a right at the next intersection and walked up to the front door of what passed for a townhouse in a frontier city. The building was a narrow 2 stories, a mix of wood and plaster construction, with a sharply slanted roof and cheerful, bright green shutters. Prime let himself in, leaving Vlora lurking at the corner and completely uncertain about what to do next. She carefully cast her senses toward the townhouse, feeling around with a light, tentative touch for wards. There were all sorts of passive things a privilege could do to protect a location. Doorknobs could be warded to stun or kill anyone who touched them. Floors could inform the privileged when someone had walked upon them. And whole buildings could be prepped to explode when entered. Wards were also, as far as Vlora was aware, next to impossible to hide completely. Field Marshal Tamas had been an expert at detecting wards. He'd even taught Vlora how to pick a ward apart, something that most privileged still considered impossible for a powder mage. But Vlora had never really caught on to the latter ability. The former, however, she'd grown quite good at. Yet she sensed nothing, even when she poked around for the telltale signs of a ward that had been folded in on itself to hide it. She was beginning to wonder if she'd gone mad when the front door of the townhouse opened. She took a half step back, trying to look inconspicuous. Prime didn't even look up, staring at the front of his folded newspaper with a scowl as he walked briskly past her. She waited a few moments, then turned to follow him. Had he already noticed her and was leading her into a trap? She tried to remember every detail about him. He was an academic, supporting Tamas during the Adran coup, and had apparently masqueraded as a succession of vice-chancellors of Adapest University for hundreds of years. He might genuinely be absent-minded, content that his power kept him hidden. Vlora was deep in thought when she looked out to find that she was no longer following Prime. Her heart quickened, and she doubled her pace, hurrying to the next intersection. She checked doorways and alleys for 50 yards. She even looked back down the street to see if he'd double back. No such luck. He had disappeared entirely. Vlora swore under her breath. This asshole could disappear, both in this world and in the else. She couldn't see him. She couldn't sense him. He could be standing right behind her, and she wouldn't notice it. She doubled back around the block several times, just in case she had missed him. After waiting for nearly 10 minutes for him to reappear, she headed to his townhouse, where she walked up to the front door, took a hit of powder, and closed her eyes. In a deep powder trance, she could hear footsteps, heavy breathing, sometimes even a heartbeat. She tried to focus on the house, ignoring the ambient sound of the street. Nothing. Searching his residence might turn up clues to the Godstone's location. But if she hadn't been able to sense him disappear, that meant that he could create wards that she couldn't sense either. Walking straight into his house might get her killed. She waffled on the front step for a moment before noticing an old woman sweeping the steps of the next house over. The woman glanced up, noticed that Vlora was watching her, and leaned heavily on her broom.
"What are you selling?"
she demanded. The question caught Vlora off guard. Excuse me?
"The gentleman who owns that house doesn't like to be bothered. If you're selling something, you can tell me, and I'll let him know when he's next in."
"Does he often buy things?"
"Never. But he likes to know who's knocking on his door, so you can either leave me a card or bugger off."
Laura hesitated, trying to concoct some sort of story that wouldn't make Prime suspicious. Coming up with nothing, she tipped her hat to the old woman and made her retreat, heading down the street without a backward glance, and frustrated that she'd not learned anything new about Prime. She corrected herself on that last thought. She had learned two things. One, that Prime could disappear at will, and two, that Prime paid his neighbours to watch the house for him while he was out. If he was worried about being tracked down, it meant he was hiding something, and she was willing to bet it wasn't just his own sorcerer's nature. Chapter 34 The Mad Lancers left Belport, heading west along the northern coast of the Hammer. They travelled slowly, sending out as many scouts as they dared, and avoiding the larger towns and cities already flying the Dainai's flag. They even stayed several miles inland to avoid being spotted by Dainai ships, of which, their scouts informed them, there were dozens plying the waters back and forth between Fatrasta and Dainai's. Stike kept to himself for several days, content to ride with the rearguard, while recovering from the beating Valjane gave him, and teaching Celine how to handle her new horse. The creature turned out to be more stubborn than Stike had initially guessed, and would have found itself discarded with the rest of the extra horses, had Celine not taken an equally stubborn liking to it. Frequent reports came from Ibana with a vanguard. Stike read the reports and sent orders to the front. During the evenings, he helped train the newest recruits, having picked up almost 500 volunteers in Belport, while Celine continued to learn Karpol's language. On the fourth day of riding, Stike heard the distant report of artillery and made his way up the winding line of cavalry, joining Abana with the vanguard over a mile ahead. She sat on her horse on a clifftop, eyes focused on something in the distance. Jackal, bearing the Mad Lancer standard, sat with her. To the northwest, Stike was able to see the source of the cannon fire that continued to echo across the water. There was a small fortress, whose name had long since escaped him, positioned at the end of a long breakwater. It overlooked the space between the Hammer and an unnamed island, and it was exchanging a violent torrent of fire with a sizable Dainai's fleet positioned in a half-moon around the fortress. "I'm guessing," Ibana said without lowering her looking-glass, "that you've been skulking with the rearguard the last few days, 'cause you failed to kill Valjane?" Stike glanced around. The only people within earshot were Jackal, Celine, and Karpol. Stike looked to Jackal, whose pale freckles had darkened with all the time out in the sun. Jackal simply lifted his hands. This was not something he wanted to get involved in.
"I've been teaching Celine to ride a new horse."
Ibana snapped her looking-glass closed and turned towards Stike.
"I heard you let Valjane beat the shit out of you."
Let," seems a strong word. He's a champion boxer.
And you have the biggest knife on the continent, Ibana retorted. Why the pit did you square up with fisticuffs against a champion boxer?
I wanted to see if I could kill him with my fists.
Well, it didn't work out. He betrayed you, and he's still alive.
I can always go back and gut him later, Stike said,
the words coming out a little more petulant than he'd intended. Ibana fixed Stike with a long stare and then turned to Celine.
What's her name, sweetheart? She asked gently, indicating Celine's horse.
Celine beamed.
Margot. She already had the name, and I liked it, so I decided to let her keep it.
That's a good name, Ibana replied. She nudged her own horse, quickly trotting around Margot before nodding.
Looks like a good horse.
Ben bought it for me.
There was an edge of challenge in Celine's voice, as if daring Ibana to question the man who would acquire a horse for a little girl. Stike almost laughed out loud. He butted in before Ibana could get annoyed.
I haven't been hiding, he said.
Good, Ibana said simply. She drew closer to Stike, letting her voice fall. She didn't look happy with what she was about to say, but she continued on.
You know it just as well as I do. The Mad Lancers ride on their reputation. On your reputation. You start sparing people who've betrayed you, and people will think you've gone soft. The prospect of your knife is the only thing that keeps some of these bastards in line.
Stike sat back in his saddle, unsure how to respond. He remembered Agaston's blood running down his arms, and then sparing Tenny Wiles.
I start to get uppity, and I'll set him straight.
It's never come to that before. I don't want it to come to that. Stike snorted.
Let me handle my vengeance the way I see fit.
I will. It's just a word of warning, that's all.
Thank you, Stike replied.
Ibana nodded and rode off a few dozen yards, pulling out her looking-glass to watch the distant bombardment. Stike turned to Jackal.
How's the ride been?
Easy enough, Jackal said. Scouts are keeping us clear of Dionysus' forces. How's the rear guard?
Boring,
Stike replied. He nodded to the distant fortress.
Do the spirits tell you how much longer that fortress will last?
Jackal's eyes immediately went over Stike's shoulder, and it took him a moment to realize Jackal was looking directly at Carpole.
Are you kidding? Only the bravest spirits will come within a mile of her. I can always tell when she's getting near because they flee before she arrives.
You hear that, Blood Lady? Stike called. The spirits are afraid of you.
Carpole seemed entirely unimpressed.
But it doesn't take
the spirits, Jackal said, returning his gaze to the distant fort, to see they're almost done for.
There's six ships of the line out there, and two brigades cutting off any support from the mainland. The fortress will fall within days.
He gave Stike a curious look.
Are we going to relieve them?
Stike glanced at Carpole.
Is the Godstone in that fort?
She shook her head.
No, he told Jackal. I'm not suicidal enough to charge two brigades in clear view of a supporting enemy fleet.
Besides, he added to himself, they'd already resupplied at Belport.
We'll have to swing around those two brigades. With luck, they'll be so focused on the fort that they won't even notice us.
Stike heard a sudden shout from down the road. He turned, curious, and was soon joined by Ibana.
What was that? She asked.
I'm not sure.
Stike lifted Amrek's reins, spotting a dust cloud rising from a nearby hill, and a familiar old face suddenly burst into view. Sunin Teal clung to her horse's neck, both she and her animal streaming tears from the hard ride, her wrinkled skin covered in a sheen of sweat. She stood in the stirrups, not bothering to slow.
"We've been ambushed!" she shouted. "Dionysus cavalry from the rear!"
Stike whipped Amrek into a gallop. "Stay with Selene," he ordered Sunin. He pointed a finger behind him as he charged past. "And keep Karpol out of the fight!" He and Ibana raced along the road, past the milling of confused cavalrymen. Stike came around the hill into the valley that contained the bulk of his forces, taking in the situation at a glance. Dionysus' dragoons had swept in from the southern end of the valley, crossing a small creek, and opening fire with carbines on the Mad Lancers, who were still strung out along the road. There were at least 3,000 dragoons, with more coming over the hill, and they raked the Lancers' flank with perfect precision, hitting them with a torrent of carbine fire in companies of 100 before retreating out of range to reload. The Lancers were in chaos. Those that tried to fire back couldn't pack a big enough punch, and the few that charged were deftly avoided and gunned down. Another wave of dragoons suddenly appeared at the other end of the valley, blocking a retreat along the road and engaging the rear guard with a withering fusillade. Stike pressed Amrek harder, weaving among his confused troops.
"Ibana!" he shouted. "Take the vanguard and swing around to their flank! They're not wearing breastplates! Hit the bastards with our lances!"
He continued on without waiting for an answer, galloping toward the rear guard and the fresh recruits being cut to ribbons. He passed Major Gustav, who just barely organized the Riflejack Cavalry Corps enough to return fire.
"Press them hard!"
Stike shouted, slowing just enough to get his orders out.
"That hill they came down was easier for them to descend than it will be to go back up. Send your cuirassiers straight at their center."
Stike was quickly past. He urged Amrek harder, watching as more of his cavalry fell to the enemy carbine volleys. The Dionysus became bolder, pressing in on the rear guard, not bothering to retreat before they reloaded their weapons. Stike finally reached the rear guard, who were desperately trying to reload their own carbines.
"Blast the carbines!" Stike roared as he whipped past them. "Lances down! Charge!"
He snatched up his lance, lowering the steel tip as he broke through the confused line of his own men and up the open road toward the Dionysus. Dragoons had come within 10 yards, and they seemed shocked to see him charging toward them, wearing one of their own breastplates. A bullet whizzed past Stike's ear, and he felt another slam into the breastplate, jerking him back in the saddle. He kept his hold on the reins and on his lance, leaning forward. The closest Dionysus fumbled with his carbine, dropped it, then tried to urge his horse to run in the opposite direction. Stike's lance clipped him in the side, tearing out 4 inches of flesh and several feet of intestine, and burying it into the next dragoon. Letting go of his weighty lance, Stike drew his cavalry sword and urged Amrek forward, laying about him with his weapon. Gore whipped from the rise and fall of his sword. Blood spattered his lips, but Stike didn't bother to check if it was his own or the enemy's. Their sudden onslaught turned to confusion at his charge, and still he pushed deeper, using Amrek's mighty chest to shove past the smaller Dionysus horses. Only upon turning to block the sword thrust of an enemy did Stike see that the new recruits had not actually followed him into the fray. Some of them stared at him dumbly, while others fumbled for their lances. It wasn't until Jackal appeared, waving the skull and lance flag and charging forward, that they seemed to break out of their shock and attack. A straight-bladed dragoon sword caught in the clasp of Stike's breastplate. He sheared off the arm holding it and discarded the blade, but the clasp snapped at the next impact of an enemy bullet. With one quick movement, Stike bit down on Amrek's reins and used his left hand to pry the other clasp off the broken breastplate. He swung it over his head and threw it at a charging dragoon, knocking the rider off his horse. Reins still between his teeth, he drew his boss knife and rammed it into the chest of a man whose mount had been pushed too close in the melee. He jerked it out and threw it overhand into the neck of a horse. The horse screamed, throwing its rider. Stike finally fought his way to the top of the ridge, looking down at the road. It was covered with the bodies of men and horses, almost all of them belonging to the new recruits from Bellport, stragglers who'd fallen behind the rearguard. With a glance, Stike could see how the dragoons had come out of the trees, catching them completely unawares and slaughtering them without a fight. The glance also told him that he'd reached the very edge of this wave of dragoons. They had no more men attacking the rearguard. He whirled to rally the rear, to dispose of these dragoons and join Gusta and Ibana to fight their main force. Something struck his shoulder just as he drew breath to bellow encouragement. He turned to see a dragoon charging him at full speed, smoking carbine being exchanged for a straight-edged sword. The rider didn't have time to fully draw her sword before her horse struck Amric in the shoulder, sending both Amric and Stike tumbling. Stike barely managed to throw himself clear. Amric fell on his side, legs flailing, finally righting himself and charging off before Stike could call to him. The Dainai's dragoon allowed her own horse to regain its balance before turning on a dime and pointing her sword at Stike and digging in her heels. Stike searched for his sword, only to see it caught in Amrek's harness as the beast galloped away. He felt for his knife, remembered throwing it, and began to loudly swear at himself. The dragoon leapt into a gallop, her sword held to her side as she swooped in towards Stike. He remained on her sword side for as long as he dared, then leapt in front of the charging horse and across to the opposite side. Before the dragoon could change her sword hand, Stike set the foot of his good leg and barreled, shoulder first, into the soft side of the Dainai's horse. Both horse and rider went flying. The impact knocked the breath from Stike and nearly threw him on his ass. He barely stayed on his feet and ran toward the horse that, still flailing with pain, had his boss knife in its neck. He jerked the knife out, reversed his hold on it, and rammed the blade into the creature's spine with one quick motion, putting it out of its misery. A shout of challenge was the only warning he got. The persistent dragoon leapt toward him, sword thrusting, and Stike barely parried the thrust with the blade of his knife. He charged forward, closing the distance, ramming his left fist into the dragoon's face. She reeled back but did not fall, driving him off with blind swipes of her sword. They both froze, staring at each other, giving Stike his first good look at his opponent. She was tall, not as tall as he or Ibana, but nearly so, and she had wide shoulders that reminded him of Valjean. She was broad-faced, with quick eyes, and her red hair shorn to a finger's length. Her teal uniform had orange epaulets, which, Stike assumed, meant she was an officer. Over his shoulder he could hear Jackal urging the rearguard to finish off their Dainai's attackers. The dragoon regarded him for another long moment, her eyes flicking to her fallen cavalry, before suddenly turning and sprinting toward the closest empty saddle. She pulled herself onto horseback with incredible dexterity and was galloping back toward the edge of the forest before Stike could take a dozen steps. He turned at the sound of a trumpet, watching as the Dainai's cavalry disengaged from the mad lancers and began to retreat. The lancers, for their part, were obviously badly mauled, and he was not surprised when Ibana did not give the order to follow. He found the dragoon officer's horse where he'd shoved it over. The poor creature thrashed in pain with one leg broken and probably several cracked ribs. Stike calmed it as best he could and covered its eyes with one arm before putting it out of its misery. He found Amric and went back up the road in search of Ibana.
"That was a timely charge," he told Jackal as he passed.
Jackal waved back at him,
The spirits wouldn't forgive me if I allowed you to die charging an enemy army alone.